Welcome to Breakfast at Beverley's, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the fascinating world of transport and logistics. Join your host, Beverley Bell CBE, an industry expert and former senior traffic commissioner, as she navigates the highways and byways of the industry. From sunrise to sunset, we're here to accompany you on the road, bringing you insights, advice, and thought-provoking conversations with notable guests in the field. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Today we are delighted to have Laura Thomas with us. Laura is an award-winning leading lawyer with tremendous expertise in regulatory law, health and safety, environment, transport, governance and risk and compliance. There's no end to Laura's talents. She's held executive positions in the oil and gas and civil engineering sectors and currently has her own strategic risk consultancy called Consultee. Laura is also a mental health first aider, a deputy traffic commissioner, and an empathetic leader who brings a unique approach to solving business and legal challenges. I, for one, can't wait to chat with Laura. So, Laura, thank you very much indeed for travelling all the way over to the Isle of Wight to come and talk to us and take part in this podcast.
My pleasure.
We had a lovely meal last night.
We did. Thank you very much.
Did you have any breakfast?
Yes, I had breakfast when I got here, and it was lovely. I had a croissant and some very nice jam.
Is that your normal breakfast?
No. Interestingly, I'm not, which is a bit ironic given I'm here for breakfast at Beverley's, I'm not a big breakfast person during the week. I tend to start the day with a cup of tea and then I don't really eat until late morning.
Do you do any exercise in the morning?
No.
Excellent. I like you more and more, Laura. We'll carry on.
I'd love to say yes, but no.
This meeting's going to go well. Well, you do exercise, don't you? Because you have your lovely horse.
I do, yes. So I horse riding's my exercise, but it's also my stress relief. I love it. I just love being outdoors. I love the smell of my horse. Strange, some people might say.
No, smells very evocative.
But I do. And I love it when it's just, we go out into the woods or to the beach or to the water, and fantastic.
Do you live near the beach then?
Do, very lucky.
But exercise and mental health and physical health and how we feel are all interlinked, aren't they?
Totally.
So before we come on to that, I've looked at your CV. Mm-hmm. And you describe yourself as a barrister with a difference.
Yes.
What's the difference, Laura?
I'm a barrister that wears a wig and a hard hat, I suppose, is the difference.
At the same time,
no. I think what makes me really different is I'm a barrister that's actually worked in industry. I've held executive roles in industry. And so I've not just done law in theory, I've done law in practice. And I've done business and risk management in practice.
So I'm going to ask you how you came into the law. Did you always want to be a lawyer when you were 5 years of age? Did you say, Mummy, I want to be a lawyer? Or did it happen later in life?
Yeah, pretty sure I didn't when I was five. I think at that point, I don't know what I wanted other than to have a pony. And I eventually got one and it was basically wild. My parents obviously didn't like me very much and the thing used to throw me off all the time. But that's how I started in horses. No, I think for me, law came later. And it was mainly because I grew up on a Welsh mountain, fantastic place to live. And our neighbour was a barrister and then became a judge. And he's such a lovely man. He passed away actually last year. Such a wonderful man, Derek Hulbert. And he introduced me to the world of law. None of my family were in law. Didn't know anything about it. I just thought it sounded so exciting. So I spent a bit of time with him and he let me sit up on the judge's bench with him and do some work experience, and it was amazing. And I thought, yeah, this is for me. Interestingly, I found out subsequently he spoke to my dad when I said I wanted to be a barrister. He said, I'm not really sure it's for Laura because she's quite sensitive. I'm just not sure if it's going to be the right thing for her. But I did it.
And you made a great success of it. Mm. So you did your law degree at Oxford.
I did.
Of course, at Oxford, they call it jurisprudence.
They do. Yes, obviously. I have to have some laugh.
Why Oxford?
I went to a lovely little village state school in North Wales, and my head of year said to me, "You're clever, you should apply for Oxford." And that's sort of why it happened. Funnily enough, I do remember as a child going to visit my auntie quite a lot in Hampshire and going past Oxford. And my mum always saying, "Look at the Dreaming Spires, Laura." And I'd be sitting in the back saying, "That's nice." So my mum was really quite ill at that point, but she applied for some prospectuses for me.
And I bet they arrived in the post in an
envelope. They arrived in the post.
Didn't they? Very exciting to read them. Yeah. I remember those days.
And she applied for a prospectus for Christchurch because that was the one that she remembered seeing as we drove past Oxford. And that's where I ended up. So, yeah, bit of a random story. Not most people's stories about going to Oxford, but yeah, it was quite a different experience for me from my upbringing.
I can imagine completely different from what you did. So if you're advising young people now, if there are any young people out there listening to our podcast, please tell us and please tell your friends. What would you say to aspiring lawyers or indeed anybody that's looking now to go into their new career? Should they just work hard and just study for the exams and just do work experience all the time? Or is there more to it?
For me, I think there's much more to it. When I was a partner at Birkett's, I was one of the graduate recruitment partners, and I would see a huge amount of CVs coming across my desk of young people who'd done the most amazing things. But that was sort of the given. I mean, when I was younger, it was a bit easier in the sense if you have work experience, that was a really good thing. Now it's expected that you'll have work experience. It's expected that you will study very well, and it's expected that you'll get amazing grades. So for me, I was always looking for something a little bit different. I really loved seeing CVs of young people who'd, you know, had a Saturday job from the age of 16 and stuck at it and had some experience in life that wasn't just academic, wasn't just focused on career profession, whether that's traveling, whether that's charity work. As I said, you know, working in Greggs or, you know, bars or pubs or whatever that might be, I think showing that you are committed to something and you can see something through, that you're passionate about things, about life.
Resilient,
hugely important. So things like sport and music or drama, whatever your passion might be. To show that you've really gone for it.
Okay. So just go back to your parents for a moment. You post a lot on LinkedIn. I follow you on LinkedIn. Lots of people follow you on LinkedIn. They really enjoy your posts, especially the one with you and your boys when they're mudlarking around.
Oh, yeah, that was quite special. Yes. My car still hasn't recovered.
I was going to say the car must be looking pretty bad.
No.
But your parents, I've asked if I can talk to you about this, and you're quite happy to. You lost your mother when you were only 17 and your father when you were 26.
That's right.
How has that impacted on you?
Oh, I mean, hugely. More than I can ever really say. I think the one thing it's taught me is to look after yourself. I think we all really need to look after ourselves because there have been times, particularly in my 20s and actually into my 30s, when my mental health has been really poor as a result. And I think the trauma I suffered from losing, particularly my mother at that age, when I was 17, I say mother, I never called her mother, mum, losing mum when I was 17. Definite trauma, and it has impacted my life considerably. But there is good from everything. And I think the good that I've realized is I spent, a lot of my life up until that point working really hard, getting the exams, getting the grades, that sort of thing, which has stood me in really good stead. Of course it has. But we've got to look after ourselves. You know, we've got to do the things that make us happy, that make us want to get up in the morning. And for me, that's, you know, the outdoors, my family, my horses, my dogs, two crazy dogs.
And your work?
And my work now. Yeah, it hasn't always been my work. You know, I think I'd be sitting here and lying if I said I've always enjoyed work. There've been times where it's been difficult, challenging, probably a little bit too much, dare I say stressful. But now I think I'm so fortunate to have the balance I've got.
Okay, so we talked about your mother getting the prospectus for Christchurch. Yes. Tell us what your father did.
So my dad grew up in the Northwest. He did an apprenticeship at Pilkington Glass up there.
In St Helens.
In St Helens. He was a St Helens boy. And he worked his way up and then eventually did a degree at Manchester Uni in engineering and joined Mobil Oil, as it then was. I think it's now Exxon Mobil, possibly. And he worked his way up and eventually was chief engineer at their Birkenhead plant. I said I'd say that. I've not said it very well, have I? I'll be honest. And I was really proud of my dad. You know, he's very working class upbringing, but he just worked so, so hard to get where he was. And then when he left Mobil, he became a management consultant. And he founded Consultee, which is the business name that I've now taken for my little business.
And that's a lovely story about how you've continued that name and that heritage. And it leads us very nicely into the work you do, not as a barrister, but as a consultant.
Yes.
You are an expert in health and safety legislation. You have established yourself as that expert. How did you, and I won't say how did you fall into health and safety, because that would be a cheap trick, but how did you work in health and safety? Mm. How did that come about?
I think I probably did fall into it, to be honest. When I was a criminal barrister, so after I left university, I went to London and I was in a wonderful criminal chambers called 2 Bedford Row. And I did some fantastic work there. And one of the opportunities that I had when I was at 2 Bedford Row was to do a secondment at the Health and Safety Executive, the HSC.
What year would this be?
Oh, good question. It's probably about 2003, 2004. Okay. And so I spent a number of months at the HSC and I didn't really know anything about health and safety. I was a criminal barrister. I did, you know, your dare I say bog standard crime, is there such a thing? But that's what I did. And I went to HSC and I learned very quickly about health and safety law and I started advising on health and safety prosecutions, what should be prosecuted, what shouldn't. And then when I left, the HSC instructed me a lot to prosecute cases for them, as usually as junior barrister to the legendary Richard Matthews.
The legendary Richard Matthews,
lovely man.
I think we're both sort of members of the Richard Matthews family.
Totally, yeah.
Along with lots
lovely
of other
man.
People.
Lovely man. He was
not just lovely, but incredibly wonderful in the work he does.
I think somebody asked me recently, what makes a good barrister? And for me, a good barrister, or in fact, a good anyone, is somebody who can take really tricky, difficult concepts and make them simple. And he is just amazing at that.
And he makes it look so easy, you think you could do it.
Totally. And then you realise it's really hard.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we've gone off at a tangent with Richard Matthews, as we always do. But going back to, so you would be his junior, he would lead.
Absolutely. And then I prosecuted a few cases on my own. And I thought, no, this is quite me, actually. I liked the challenge of health and safety law because it's not just about law, it's about practice and understanding different industries, different businesses, how things are done. And it was quite a change from the criminal law, which by that point, I felt I'd probably done.
Which is where your hard hat and your wig came in, because
you're
going from the wig to the hard hat.
Absolutely.
So you've had a number of operational roles.
Yes.
But as a front line, but also in your consultancy work, advising individual clients, large companies generally,
yes.
I think, on their health and safety.
Yeah.
There was a spell where you moved to Birkett's.
Yes.
And, you know, you were at Birkett's and you were doing lots of different work there. Just tell our listeners a little bit about what you did, and then I want to come back to the health and safety piece.
Yeah, so I joined Birkett's in 2007, I believe. And at that point, Birkett's is a much smaller firm than it is now. It's now pretty huge. Big firm, a huge firm. There's offices all over the place. They wanted to focus on regulatory law. They wanted to build a regulatory practice. There was a wonderful solicitor there called Malcolm Savory, who had been doing the work for a long time. They wanted to build the team, and he wanted to start to retire, although it took him a very long time to retire. And by the time I left in 2019, I believe, the team was 10 strong. We had a great practice, very interesting work. And so I felt my mission had been accomplished, I suppose. The work predominantly for me, it was a regulatory and corporate defence team, so it covered all regulatory law, but I focused really on the health and safety. So I essentially defended in health and safety cases for 12 years.
So you went from prosecuting them to defending them.
Absolutely.
So you've seen it on both sides.
Yes.
What's the one piece of advice, Laura, that you would give to any of your clients, whether they are a small or medium-sized enterprise or whether they are a massive organisation? What's the one piece of advice you would give to them?
In respect of health and safety.
In respect of health and safety.
I have a mantra. And that is, say what you do, do what you say, and then have the paperwork to prove it. Health and safety is not about paperwork. It's about practice. So the one piece of advice is make sure you really know what's going on in your business, not what you say is going on in your business.
Or not what you think is going on in your business.
Absolutely.
Or what you don't know is going on in
Absolutely.
Your business.
Absolutely.
So whilst you are a deputy traffic commissioner, we don't want to talk about traffic commissioners. They're far too boring. It's much more interesting to talk about health and safety law. And I know very little about health and safety law. So it's great to be able to pick your brains. Where does the transport industry sector fit in that sort of league table? Mm-hmm. Is it a leader in health and safety? Is it at the bottom? Is it somewhere in the middle? And then you've got to justify what you say.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I wouldn't say generally the transport industry is a leader in health and safety. I'm sure there are pockets of excellence, and I'm not detracting from that. But generally speaking, probably wouldn't say a leader. And I also wouldn't say they're at the bottom either. I'd say there's certainly somewhere in the middle from my experience of transport. But I think what I see quite a lot in the transport industry, and forgive me if you're not one of these operators that acts in this way, but there's quite a lot of tick boxing and please sign here in health and safety and transport. A lot of reliance on, yes, we gave that toolbox talk. Look, here's a piece of paper with all these signatures on. And then when I delve into, well, what did the toolbox talk actually involve? And can you be sure that the people delivering it knew how to deliver it? Can you be sure that the message landed? What was the key message? Usually I'm met with, well, I wouldn't say blank faces, but quizzical faces. So I think for me, the shift in the transport industry perhaps needs to be from paperwork to practice and really understanding the practice and not dictating. Making sure that people know why you're asking them to behave in a certain way, why these control measures are in place, rather than just saying, this is what you need to do, please sign here, or not even please, sign here.
Whether you understand it or not.
Absolutely.
And don't we all love a driver handbook, Laura?
Oh, the driver handbooks I've seen in my life. I think I could almost sort of write a story about the driver handbooks I have seen in my career. I think it's quite interesting. And it happened very recently to me, an operator handing me a driver handbook, so proud of it. You know, it literally looked like it had just come off the photocopier. It was beautiful. It was heavy. I opened it up. There was an index that went almost onto two pages. so many words in this document. And I could tell the operator was so proud, and I didn't want to completely dispel any, you know, any kind of pride in their work. Mm. But honestly, when I looked at it, I thought anyone would struggle to get through this amount of paper and words. Really, can we be sure our drivers have actually read it and are interested in it? And I could categorically say no. They clearly hadn't, and they clearly wouldn't. So for me, I'm almost the antithesis of that. I don't like there being too much paper. I don't like there being too many words. I like drivers, and anyone, in fact, to be able to understand what they're being told and be able to relate to it. And so, no, I'm not a big fan of a driver handbook. And funnily enough, I'd had one operator say to me really recently, and I thought it really made me laugh, actually, that their concern about their driver handbook was that if there was ever a crash, that the driver would be knocked out by the driver handbook, which I thought, I really loved that. But I loved, actually, that they recognised that, you know, recognised that for whatever reason, sort of the industry has just turned to creating more and more and more and more paperwork to solve problems, but it doesn't solve problems.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't solve them at all. Of course, there are other ways now drivers can get information, aren't there? QR codes, those sorts of things.
Absolutely.
Can be a good way.
WhatsApp groups can be really effective. Particularly when drivers are remote, you know, I've seen WhatsApp groups being used really effectively. You know, one of the good things COVID gave us was, you know, Teams calls and remote working in that way, which can be really effective as
yes.
well.
And whilst we're not going to talk about, it sounds like we're sort of recovering traffic commissioners really, doesn't it? We're not going to talk about sort of transport law. There is an issue around management of drivers, and we'll talk more about management of drivers. We run these two-day refresher courses, and we talk about what you can do remotely in terms of management and what has to be done face-to-face. Mm. So WhatsApp has its place, and WhatsApp groups have their place. Mm. And we're going to come on to talk about it hopefully in a moment about actually dealing with drivers face to face. So if we look at drivers as a specific group, remembering, of course, that we tend to use the phrase drivers, but it covers so many areas.
Absolutely.
Right across the sectors.
Yeah.
Right across the types of people that choose to become drivers or have it foisted on them.
Yeah.
There's a whole huge area now and debate about drivers' mental health and well-being.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very old and I've been banging on about it for years, you know, well before COVID, probably 10, 15 years before then, as have lots of others. And now it's on the agenda. It's out there for people to talk about. And whilst you and I may talk about it, drivers often don't want to, do they?
No, it's a tricky thing, isn't it? I mean, I just want to say at the outset, I have huge respect for drivers. I think it is such a difficult job. And the professionalism that I see day in, day out is staggering, really. I think it's a very tricky job. It's a very isolating job. It can have health issues with the fact that it's a very sedentary job. It removes people from their support structures, often for long periods of time. And it's difficult. Drivers' hours, I mean, you know, they're difficult to navigate. All of the things that drivers have to do means it's a hugely responsible job. So I'm going to say that straight away because I'm a huge advocate for drivers.
Oh,
I think they're incredible. And I think actually they're not, dare I say it, some operators don't give drivers the respect they deserve. Sorry, I've put it out there.
I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you.
And I can't even remember the question now because I got on my soapbox about drivers.
Not at all. We were talking about how if you ask a driver, or indeed any of us, ask any of us in the room, how are you today?
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
How do you advise your clients to deal with that driver who says, I'm fine, when they may think they're not fine?
So I'm going to go back a little bit on that and just give a little bit about my sort of theories on health and safety, because that ties in perfectly with what you've just said. I'm a firm believer that mental health and well-being is fundamental to any good health and safety strategy. and always have been. Of all of the tragedies I have dealt with throughout my career, and there've been some awful cases that I've handled, when you look at a root and branch approach and you really understand what's happening, the person involved has generally had a really bad day for whatever reason. And I firmly believe, therefore, that a strong well-being and mental health strategy supports good health and safety. And in fact, any business. You know, as I said, a lot of my roles have actually been just executive roles in business, and it makes good sense. A good culture makes sense for good business. So back to drivers, it's not just drivers, actually. I do a lot of work in construction industry, and it's very similar there as well. And perhaps, I don't know, is it male-dominated industries? I honestly don't know what it is. But generally speaking, I think if you ask most people, how are you? We all just sort of say, yeah, fine, great, fine, thank you, lovely. Actually, you might have had the, you might have had the worst day ever, but you kind of go, oh, I'm fine, no problems here. And I do see that a lot in drivers. So how do we get around that? Back to your question. I do quite a lot of work alongside, or I'm a huge fan of, back to my fan days, huge fan of Dr. Tim Marsh, who is a leading safety behavioral psychologist. And he will say, you need to ask, how are you, twice. And in between, you need to engage the person that you're speaking with, understand what makes them tick. Is it the football? Do they love football? Do they love, in my case, horses? Do they love music? What is it that they really love? Engage them in a conversation, then ask again. And you're far more likely to get an honest answer once you've actually engaged somebody, you've connected with somebody, and they feel that they can trust you with the answer. So don't think, oh, it's all right, I asked Jim how he was and he told me he was fine, that's the end of it. And part of that is about understanding your people. It's about knowing your drivers, or in fact, anybody that works with you, knowing them and being able to see if they're on their A game or not. I do appreciate it's more difficult with drivers because they are often out and isolated. And often when I work with hauliers, that's the response I get back. Well, how do I know? Well, you make it your business to know, because it is good business to know.
And it's not just hauliers, is it? No. Bus and coach industry.
Absolutely.
Very similar problems with isolation.
Very similar.
Sedentary, but they have the different pressure, I won't say added, different pressure of also managing the passengers.
Absolutely.
Which can be
public. We are an interesting bunch, aren't we, as human beings?
And I think in Britain, drivers are not valued. They were in COVID.
Yes.
And they were in, you're too young to remember this because you were probably about 12 at the time, but when we had the fuel strikes, it was about the year I became a TC in 2000. And I think in 2000, you were...
I was just finishing university.
Yes, that's what I thought.
And I was
yes.
at bar school.
Yeah. Making me very old, feel very old. But they were those two times when I think the British public appreciated the drivers, whereas if you go to lots of our continental friends, they are much more seen as professionals.
Absolutely.
And treated, quite frankly, a lot better.
Well, if you look at the facilities they have in Europe, I mean, considerably better. I've got lots of friends who are drivers. And some of the things I hear about the facilities here, I appreciate that's not what we're here to talk about, but
it's all part of it.
It's horrendous. You know, drivers, there, if you are a bus company, a haulier, an operator of any type, without your drivers, you have no business. So we've got to start valuing drivers, looking after drivers, making sure they have the facilities they need. It's so, so important.
So if that's talking about drivers, let me ask you now about some of the operators, the clients.
Yeah.
And this is more likely to be a transport audience.
Yes.
But obviously, other people are free to listen and hopefully not be too bored by it. And I'm sure they won't be listening to you at call.
I'm not sure about that.
No, they won't. But what about the directors?
Yeah.
What about those board level members? How do you win their hearts and minds? How do you say you need to do this because it's good for your mental health, or it's good for your physical health, or it's good for the company's health? How do you sell that message? What advice would you give to our listeners, to those that are at board level that are listening?
I think I can only work in that regard. I can work from personal experience because I have held those roles. And I know that if I didn't look after myself, I couldn't be the best that I could be for the business and for those that work, that I work for. I was going to say that work for me, because I've always felt in a leadership role that I work for the team and they don't work for me. But I need to show up and be the best I can for my team. And unless I look after myself, that just won't happen. And I know that from personal experience and, you know, having suffered badly with depression a few times in my life, I know that it's a little bit like the gas mask thing, isn't it? You've got to put your own gas mask on before you put someone else's on.
Yes, and even oxygen.
Oxygen, absolutely.
As long as the gas is oxygen, Laura, we're going to be fine.
The oxygen mask. Yeah, absolutely. Not gas mask. That'd be a whole different thing. But no, you're right. I think it's about that, really. It's about being the best you can for your team and showing up and making sure that you are giving them the circumstances in which to thrive. And that can't be right if you're not looking after yourself.
And the culture of the company is so important in that, isn't it?
Hugely important.
Because if you've got a hard-working culture, especially some of the big law firms in the city, you know, you've got to work X hours a day, etc., then that's not too great. So I'm very conscious of time, but I want to ask you, what's one of your big standout moments in your career? Doesn't have to be health and safety. It can be anything in your career. What are your big standout moments?
There've been a few, but I think the one that I will never forget is when I was at the criminal bar. So I was in criminal chambers and my pupil master, as they're then called, pupil supervisor, as they're now quite rightly called, was Treasury Counsel at the Old Bailey, which meant I had the opportunity to see big cases from very early on in my career. And I was involved in the prosecution of the individuals alleged to have committed the Damilola Taylor murder. Tragic case for those who don't know, a young boy in Peckham who was stabbed in the leg and bled to death in a stairwell. Atrocious case. And as part of that, I attended the stairwell where he died on the estate in Peckham. And there are certain things that have happened in my career that are almost, I would say, like a photograph in my mind. And I have a really clear photograph in my mind of standing at the top of the stairwell, concrete everywhere, and looking over and seeing Canary Wharf and the bright lights of the city and just feeling how awful it was for the young people that lived in that environment and how awful it was for poor Damilola who bled to death in that stairwell, when you can see out of reach but clearly there the wealth and the fortune of the city. And I think that's one thing that really... It's going back, interestingly, to the... I'm not sure if Laura's a bit sensitive to be a criminal barrister comment from my judge neighbour. I am very sensitive and I was very sensitive, and things like that really, really made me sad. So sad that these young people were just so lacking in opportunity and these awful things happen as a result. And it felt really unfair. Really, really unfair.
And how many years ago was that?
That would have been, 13, no, more than that. No, 20, about 23 years ago.
Nearly a quarter of a century. Yeah.
And I can remember it like it was yesterday. One of those things that, and I have a terrible memory now for most things. So don't start me on the menopause, honestly.
No.
That's a whole other podcast.
No. So let's just move forward before we finish. You do some charity work.
Yes.
Tell us about the Green Light Trust.
Oh, I'm so proud to be a trustee of the Green Light Trust. It's an incredible charity.
We work with, now I'll probably get this all wrong, but this is my analysis of what we do. We work with young people and adults who need additional support for whatever reason. Might be that they haven't done well in school. They're unable to be dealt with in school. It might be that they have a disability. There are so many reasons. It might be an alcohol addiction. It might be a drug addiction. They're recovering from all of these elements. And we support them by taking them effectively out into the woods and teaching them through woodwork or cooking on a campfire or coppicing or whatever. We teach them how to be more confident. We teach them life skills. We support them. We help them. It's a really tailored package that we offer these young people and adults, and the results are incredible. So yeah, I'm sorry to our CEO Lauren if I've completely described that in the wrong way, but I'm really passionate about what we do, and I'm really proud to be a trustee. I think it's an incredible charity.
Well done for doing that.
Thank you.
And two more questions, really. We talked about your parents.
Yes.
If you were going for an interview,
yes,
what advice would your mum give you?
Take a deep breath. Before you do anything, take a deep breath. And it's funny, I still do it now. And whenever I'm doing anything that pushes me out of my comfort zone, I always remember to take a deep breath. Now I tend to do box breathing. I don't know if you know about that, but I tend to do box breathing. So you breathe in for four, hold for four.
I haven't got time for that.
Out for four, hold for four. Beverly, you should do it. Honestly, it's wonderful. It really, really reduces the blood pressure. And that's when you're able to then be as good as you can be. My dad, on the other hand, is quite interesting. So this, I don't know what this says about my parents. My dad, on the other hand, would always say he was a semi-professional rugby player. So he would always say, oh, a bit of adrenaline's good, Laura.
So, I'm with your dad.
Yeah, exactly. I think maybe it's the Northwest thing, Beverly. I don't know. But yeah, he would always say a bit of adrenaline's good. You know, makes you operate your best with a bit of adrenaline. Whereas my mum was a little bit more zen.
So a good balance.
Nice balance. Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
And then just on the health and safety field, one more piece of advice that you would give either to operators or to drivers in how to prevent something awful happening in their business. Is it about culture? Is it about practices and procedures?
Oh, undoubtedly culture, without a shadow of a doubt. All of the organisations I've worked with where things have gone very badly wrong, I often speak to board members and they would say to me, or they still say to me, oh no, our health and safety is great. Look at all this paperwork. Mm. Look at all of this, and point to files on their shelves that sit there. That doesn't prevent people dying at work. It's about culture.
And you do training, don't you? You
I deliver, do. You yeah, deliver training. I do lots of training
at all levels.
Yes. Yes.
Just to, you know.
I do, and I think you know it's hugely important. And what I enjoy about training is I can use real life examples. It's not. Yes. This is not theory, this is practice. This is real life examples of what I've seen and experienced. And I hope that if that can then change any organization for the better, that's a great thing.
Joan Aitken would call it the invisibility of success, wouldn't she?
Yes.
How many people have you not injured today? How many people have you not killed today?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I've asked you lots of questions. You've answered them all beautifully, as one would expect. Is there anything you want to ask me?
That's a very good one, Beverly. And I hadn't, that's the classic, isn't it? I should have prepared for an interview and had a question to ask, which I haven't done. So I'm now going to kind of fly by the seat of my pants here and say, how was the transition from STC to working with operators?
In a way, I'm doing the same job.
Mm.
As a TC or an STC, I was putting operators, or I hoped I was putting operators back on the road to compliance.
Mm.
And I think I'm hoping to do the same here. The difference was
In my old job, if I asked, they generally said yes. I only have ever had one chappie who said no. And then he changed his mind over lunch. Now, because Stephen Kirkwright told him to. Now, we can only ever advise. And most people tend to follow the advice, but you can't make them. No. In a way, I'm going back to my roots, because before I was a TC, I was a practicing solicitor. And you build those long-term relationships with your clients, and that's what I really enjoy about the work that I do now. Plus, people have actually got to see I'm not quite the ogre that people thought I was, or that the press would make out. But I do still get asked, are you Sarah Bell's sister? I do still tell them I am not Sarah Bell's sister. So that's what I would say about the transition. The other part of the transition, and you have this, is once again having your own business.
Yeah.
And we've talked a lot about culture, and I'm thinking, am I doing the right thing in my business? Am I promoting a culture of competence and health and safety? You know, I could say we've actually got some tape on the floor.
And I can confirm, Beverly, that you very, very quickly picked that up and said, we need to take that. So you do. But actually, you know, it's not about the tape on the floor, though, is it? It's about the fact that actually all of your team had already recognised the issue. And so for me, I think the answer is yes, you clearly are fostering the right culture within the business.
We're trying. Before we finish, Laura, is there anything else you would like to tell the listeners? Anything you want to say to them? Anything you don't want to say to them?
No, I think for me, if I could just leave with my little mantra, and I'm not going to ask anyone to sort of start omming or anything, but it is say what you do, do what you say, and then have the paperwork to prove it. And that is the key. The paperwork is the end of the process, not the beginning.
Thank you. Laura, as I knew you would be, you've been a delight to have as our guest on our podcast. Thank you for coming all the way to the Isle of Wight. We hope we've looked after.
Oh, it's been lovely.
And we hope you'll really come back and talk to us another time.
I'd love to. And thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Laura.
As we conclude another fascinating journey through the world of transport and logistics, we want to express our sincere appreciation for listening. Your support means the world to us. Keep the conversation going by reaching out on social media with your questions and feedback. We're eager to hear from you and continue exploring together. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and check out our other episodes online. Take care on the roads and see you in the next episode.